Is it close enough? Over here so I could see.
Okay.
I think. Okay, thanks everyone for coming. My name is Julie Schwartzman. I'm one of the rheumatology attendings, basically the Jacoby rheumatology attending. So I think I've seen a lot of you also on the medicine wards. And like I said, thanks again for coming. Today we're going to talk about rheumatoid arthritis, and I thought I'd start out with a case report. The patient is a 39-year-old white male diagnosed with seropositive rheumatoid arthritis at the age of 17, who presented to his primary care physician with shortness of breath and intermittent nausea. He had recently reduced his daily prednisone dose from 20 milligrams to 10 milligrams because of nausea, and he was on diclofenac 50 milligrams BID and tramadol TID. But at the time he presented to his primary care doctor, he was not on any DMARDs. In addition to the steroid therapy, several different disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs had been tried in the past, including sulfasalazine, gold, chloroquine, methotrexate, and the TNF inhibitors, all of which I'll discuss with all of you a little bit later. The patient had very serious disease. He already had had a total of 16 operations, including excision of nodules, tendon repair, and bilateral knee and unilateral hip replacement. On exam at the time that he presented to his PCP, he showed signs of extensive rheumatoid arthritis, most markedly on the hand, foot, shoulder joints, as well as nodules on both elbows. His heart rate was regular but tacky, blood pressure elevated at 130 over 90, and his SED rate came back at 82. A CAT scan at that time and an echocardiogram revealed a pericardial effusion and a thickened pericardium and basal bilateral low-grade lung fibrosis. Diuretic therapy and increased prednisone dose reduced his symptoms, and the effusion was almost undetectable 4 weeks later. About 4 months later, he was admitted to the hospital because of sudden onset of abdominal pain. And at that time, he was diagnosed with a perforated ulcer thought to be NSAID and steroid-induced, and he was rushed to emergency surgery. During anesthesia, severe cardiovascular problems developed, including low blood pressure, tachycardia, and renal failure. A left and right heart cath were performed, which showed a cardiac index of 2.4, equalization of left and right pressures, and he was very sick. He had an angiogram, which revealed a 75% obstruction in the diagonal. An MRI showed a thickened pericardium, a small pericardial effusion, enlarged right atrium, and bilateral pleural effusions. The patient was diagnosed with constrictive pericarditis without hemodynamically significant pericardial effusion. This was thought to be one of his extra-articular manifestations of his disease. He was referred to CT surgery. Pericardectomy was suggested, but he refused. He was informed about how sick he was, but he declined surgery, like I said, and his condition eventually slowly improved. Over the next several months, he was hospitalized repeatedly because of right heart failure. On his final admission, he presented with cachexia, extensive edema, tachycardia, low blood pressure, orthopnea, and ascites. He had a follow-up cath, which revealed reduced ventricular function and a decreased cardiac index. Surgical intervention was again recommended, but for whatever reason, the patient still declined. In the following weeks, he had 3 episodes of renal failure attributed to low blood pressure and diuretic therapy. He intermittently required vasopressors. A CT scan at that time showed a pericardial effusion, but it was not hemodynamically relevant. So this was the CT scan performed without contrast because of his renal failure. He had a thickened pericardium and bilateral pleural effusions. He was also adrenally insufficient and pancreatic insufficient. In the following weeks, cardiovascular and renal functions were increasingly difficult to stabilize. He just progressed and progressed. He developed a DVT. He developed bilateral pneumonia despite antibiotic therapy. And he later died in septic shock and multi-organ failure. So I wanted to start with this case because I know, you know, during residency, most of the cases that you see are cardiopulmonary, and most of the patients that are, you know, the most exciting, the most interesting to take care of are the ones who are the sickest, the unit patients. But I just want, you know, an RA is not typically thought of as a disease that involves these types of presentations. But I specifically wanted to start with that just because, you know, I've seen RA patients at their later stages of their articular manifestations. But I just want you to know that the extra-articular manifestations are just as relevant for certain patients, and they're just as they're associated with just as much morbidity and mortality. And he had pericarditis, which is a frequent extra-articular manifestation, and in postmortem studies, it was shown to be found in about 30 to 50% of patients, clinically relevant in only about 3% of patients. But this was a patient who, as I told you, had nodules, had had multiple surgeries. You know, he had, you know, failed many medications, so he's one of the candidates who's going to get the extra-articular manifestations. So, rheumatoid arthritis. As you know, it's a systemic polyarthritis based on inflammation leading to joint destruction, deformity, and loss of function. There's also, as I said, several potentially severe extra-articular manifestations, which we'll discuss. The pathology of RA involves the synovial membranes and periarticular structures of multiple joints, resulting in, as you know, pain, swelling, stiffness, uncontrolled inflammation, and this can lead to irreversible damage and deformity and functional limitation. So in order to diagnose RA, the patients have to meet 4 of 7 criteria. And, you know, as I always tell you, whenever we talk about classification criteria, these were established for the entrance of patients into clinical trials. So you may find patients that early in their disease course don't have exactly 4, but, you know, if you get a strong feeling and you, you know, go through the pathways of the baseline diagnostic procedures, you could diagnose a patient with RA if they don't have exactly 4 of 7. So the criteria are morning stiffness for at least 1 hour, swelling in 3 or more joints, swelling in the hand joints, symmetric joint swelling, erosions or decalcification of the x-ray of the hands, nodules, and an abnormal serum rheumatoid factor. The prevalence of rheumatoid arthritis is much less than the prevalence of osteoarthritis, but it is fairly significant at 0.5 to 2%, 2 to 3 more prevalent in women. Every time I check my review queue for the MYSIS system, I have mostly females in there between the RA and lupus patients. Increased prevalence with increasing age. There's up to 200,000 new cases diagnosed a year. About a fifth of patients actually present with one joint, even though we typically teach you, you know, monoarthritis, look for gout, rule out infection. You know, it may be reactive arthritis, but there's a fair percentage of patients who do present with one joint. It may be oligoarticular or polyarticular. More typically, the joints of the hands, the MCPs and PIPs, are involved in presentation. But, you know, up to half of the patients actually present with the ankle joint. And that, you know, the ankle joint is a joint that we tend to focus to rule out sarcoidosis or, you know, like I said, the other, the seronegative arthropathies, but it is seen in presentation in a fair percentage of patients with RA. About 10% of patients actually go into remission, and that's with treatment, and sometimes patients can be taken off treatment. I definitely haven't been practicing long enough to see that 10% population, the people who we can take off treatment, but I guess there is a fair number. Typically, patients have a progressive course, and that's why nowadays we're starting with, you know, early aggressive therapy from the onset. Okay, so feel free to call out. What are we showing here? What do you see? Belinda? I'm going to call on you because I know your name. Right, exactly. So, good. So we see MCP and PIP joint swelling, right? And these are, this is the classic set of joints. And in most pictures, they'll show you both hands because it's the symmetric polyarthritis. And here you go. This is, the bulk of this row of MCPs is swollen. What makes it look even more swollen is because the tendons are really lax here. This is years of destruction. And this is an X-ray, basically, of the same patient. I think the next one might be a little more. So, the typical X-ray findings, the earliest ones are periarticular osteopenia, which isn't so easy to see on this image, but, you would see in this general region, the osteopenic looking bones early in presentation if the patient has early findings. Some of the other findings that you may see are symmetric erosions. And symmetric erosions means not only symmetric on equal halves of the body, like both the left and right hand, but it should really be on both sides of the bone. So you may see an erosion here. I think this is the PIP joint of that patient. And similarly on the opposite side of the same bone. Okay. Erosion at the ulnar styloid process is a classic early presentation of RA. These are the patients who may have wrist pain. They may eventually develop carpal bone fusion, like you can see in this area over here. So what do we see here?
Swan neck.
Swan neck. A little swan necking here. And what about this? Right, if it's not swan neck, it's the other one, right? So what is that called? Okay, good. So this is also a patient with severe rheumatoid arthritis. And what do we see in this picture? What's this? Good, right. And what's another polyarthritis that may present with ulnar deviation that you may diagnose on physical exam? No? So lupus patients can also have ulnar deviation, but the difference is that their ulnar deviation is actually reducible, and that's called the Jacoud's arthropathy, whereas these patients, if you try to bend their hands back to the normal position, this is their normal position, or this is their position, but lupus patients can have an ulnar deviation, but you just can reduce it. And these are highly destructive joints. You could see the periarticular osteopenia in these images and the symmetric erosions, joint space narrowing, and all the PIPs. Sorry to not be looking at you, but I'm trying to see the image on here. The PIPs are narrowed. These are symmetric erosions here. And, this is definitely a very involved patient who has barely any carpal bone space and a lot of erosions in the carpal bones as well. This is a patient who has arthritis mutilans and telescoping. Fortunately, we don't really see too many patients, except for patients who've had disease for a long time and have, but not been treated, or who are older and may not have had the availability of disease-modifying treatment anymore. But this is certainly severe arthritis. And this is just to show you that typically the feet will mirror the hands. So if a patient has, severe MCP joint findings, they also will likely have MTP pain, swelling findings, and the same thing on their X-rays. So who wants to tell me what they see? So what type of X-ray is this? What joints are these? Let's just start with that. Knees, right. You guys are so good. So what do you see in this knee joint? Okay, so just be a little bit more specific. When we identify joint space narrowing, or when we assess X-rays, we look, we try to identify which compartments of the joints are narrowed, how severe the narrowing is, right? If it's symmetric, because this picture shows us both knees. So I would say it's symmetric joint space narrowing, not just in the sense that it's both knees, but it's also in the medial and lateral components of the knee joint, okay? Whereas in osteoarthritis, you really may only see this area narrowed compared to having a decent amount of lateral joint space. So this, and rheumatoid arthritis patients, when you send them for knee X-rays, if they're advanced, you'll typically see readings that say tri-compartment joint space narrowing. So that means medial joint space narrowing, lateral joint space narrowing, and the patellofemoral joint space narrowing. So this is a patient who most likely at this point, medication, except for serious pain medication, if they have still a lot of pain, it won't help, and they may need knee replacement eventually. And this is also a very similarly highly advanced rheumatoid patient where you really don't see any joint space in the hip whatsoever. Okay, so just to review the extra-articular manifestations of rheumatoid arthritis, I already mentioned pericarditis, and we've talked about nodules, but do you know any other extra-articular manifestations that you might find? Good. Great. What else? Uveitis. So uveitis can happen. Uveitis more goes with the seronegative group. Right. Reiter syndrome, bowel disease, the psoriatic arthritis, sarcoidosis. Rheumatoid arthritis patients tend to get scleritis, which can eventually progress to scleromalacia perforans, where the sclera gets perforated, but definitely the eye. We see a lot of patients referred from the ophthalmology clinic who have uveitis or scleritis, and they want us to rule out an ongoing inflammatory autoimmune disorder. What else might they get? Good, right. Neuropathy, right? What else? Do you know about any lung manifestations of rheumatoid arthritis? Lung nodules, good. And the nodules actually have the same pathology that's going on in the synovium. I mean, they're essentially granulomas of activated immune cells collecting. Here's nodules in the PIP as well. This is a Baker cyst, but I think this patient also, I can't really see from here, is supposed to have a vasculitis as well. And here's the inflammatory eye disease. So patients with rheumatoid arthritis also can have secondary Sjogren's syndrome as opposed to the primary Sjogren's patients who don't have RA but just have Sjogren's disease. What is SICA? Do you guys know what SICA is? Right, dry eyes or dry mouth, but very good. And that's usually the presentation. But patients with Sjogren's syndrome may actually have, you know, advancing systemic disease. They may have pleuritis or pericarditis. Primary Sjogren's patients can also have kidney involvement. They are typically Rho and La positive, and they may have hyperglammoglobulinemia as well. And this is the difference. This is the irritated dry eye, dry mouth. Someone mentioned vasculitis. They may have a digital vasculitis with cutaneous ulcers, which may eventually develop a peripheral neuropathy or a mononeuritis multiplex. And here's an image. You really have to be very careful when every time you examine a rheumatoid. Not only do you have to look at, their hands, look at their joints, but you always have to, turn the hand over, look at the pulp of their fingers, look at their distal digits to make sure they don't have any of these types of lesions, because they may not even feel them. They may not notice it until it ulcerates and becomes necrotic. Patients may also have pleural disease. They may have interstitial fibrosis or nodules. They can get pneumonitis. Both of these last two also can be seen with methotrexate toxicity, which makes it interesting to treat a patient with, rheumatoid with methotrexate, but we usually do anyway. And here are some of the pulmonary nodules. As I told you before, they may have pericarditis. They can get myositis, inflammation, and conduction defects. So the articular manifestations usually have, the patients usually have swollen, tender, hot joints. When you perform an arthrocentesis, you may get a straw-colored fluid. Typically, it's inflammatory with 5,000 to 25,000 white cells. You may have a positive rheumatoid factor, which we don't usually send. Every time you tap a joint, you're going to want to send it for a cell count, and you can put in the comment or ask one of our fellows to go check for crystals. You're going to send it for gram stain and culture. And if the patient has a positive PPD and you're, looking to make sure there's no disseminated TB, you may want to send it for AFB. On presentation, they may have a leukocytosis or eosinophilia, thrombocytosis, basically all the inflammatory markers are elevated. They may have a mild chronic anemia. Typically, they'll have normal renal and hepatic function at that time, a negative ANA and positive rheumatoid factor in about 70% of patients. They also may have a positive CCP antibody. And the anti-cyclic citrullinated peptide antibodies is a new test that we have, you know, in about the last 4 years. It's very specific for RA, although it is present in several other disease processes, but we usually typically send it to confirm a diagnosis. It's present in 65% of patients with early RA. And typically, you know, we tell patients if they have a positive CCP antibody, it essentially confirms their diagnosis, and also it links them to having a more progressive disease, more erosions earlier, more joint space narrowing, more extra-articular manifestations. Oops, sorry. So the differential diagnosis for rheumatoid, I mean, I told you it's essentially an inflammatory polyarthritis, but can be a monoarthritis or an oligoarthritis. So that includes all of these seronegative polyarthritis, psoriatic arthritis, Reiter syndrome, somebody mentioned earlier, chondrocalcinosis, which is CPPD. Gout can be polyarticular, typically, you know, not in the same joints, but if a patient presents with one knee or, you know, a toe that, you know, they tend to have recurrent, you have to make sure to rule out gout, and other, you know, the polyarthropathies. Well, basically, the CCP antibody is highly specific. The rheumatoid factor can be positive in so many other disease processes, whether chronic infection, hepatitis, you know, I think the CCP is definitely better for making a diagnosis. True. Okay, so just for the purposes of keeping things and you guys awake, because I know the hour, I wanted to go through what you might do on a baseline evaluation of a patient. And this is actually a typical patient who is sent to me from clinic, or one of our fellows from clinic from you in the primary care clinic. So we have a 43-year-old African-American female who comes to the primary care doctor telling them, you know, for the past 4 months, I've had wrist and knee pain, occasional swelling in the wrists and their knuckles. She has no past medical history. She takes Tylenol for the pain, but it's not helping whatsoever. So at this point, and feel free to speak loudly because I can't hear you too well up here, but what are some of the questions that you may want to ask her to help better define this polyarthritis that she has? Good. So what other joints are you looking to hear about? Good. Okay, what else? Morning stiffness. And what? Right, good. Because definitely there's a fair amount of morning stiffness in every arthropathy, even the osteoarthritis patients, you know, because basically when you're asleep at night, your joints get gelled. So, you know, a lot of patients will have morning stiffness, but that's a good point, is the duration of morning stiffness. What else? Right. Okay, so let's just go back for a second. So he was talking about the seronegative spondyloarthropathy. So that's a good point. And you mentioned rash, but we'll get to that. So, you know, somebody who presents with a polyarthritis, you want to make sure they don't have any pertinent positives in their review for other polyarthropathies, like psoriasis, right? Ask them if they have any, you know, history of psoriasis. A family history of psoriasis is all that's required for you to make a diagnosis in a patient who you think has psoriatic arthritis of psoriatic arthritis, even if the patient doesn't have any psoriasis, okay? So ask about that. You may want to ask about, you know, IBD type of questions, any history of recurrent diarrhea. You may want to ask about any history of recurrent or recent infections, whether genitourinary, STD, you know, diarrhea illnesses, these types of questions. Another thing you want to ask about is, you know, tell me more about the swelling, because there's a lot of patients who think that their joints are swollen, but it's really, you know, it's hard to tell sometimes even for us if they have really chubby hands. You know, so ask about the swelling, ask if it gets warm, and, you know, and ask about the recurrent nature of it. Let's see, what else might you want to ask? Okay, good. Tick bites, definitely. And in the back, you were talking about, you know, going down the SLE route. So granted, she's 43, but we've definitely diagnosed patients with wrist and knee pain with lupus. So you want to rule out any of those findings. You know, ask them if they've had alopecia, photosensitivity, painless oral ulcers, you know, if they have a history of recurrent pregnancy loss, these types of things, okay? Easy bruising. Good. So, you know, like you all said, degree of joint pain and swelling, number of joints involved, presence of morning stiffness, presence of fatigue, limitation of function, and as I said, you know, going through the other pertinent positives of review of systems and other disease processes. Okay, so what's your baseline physical exam? What do you have to include in, you know, your physical exam? What are the key things to look for? Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, good. Good. And, you know, keep in mind, this is a patient who's only had disease, though, for 4 months. So she may have no deformities and she may have no restriction, but what we do when we, you know, do a joint exam is we count, and we count the number of tender joints and we count the number of swollen joints. And usually to enter any patient into a clinical trial or, you know, to actually officially make a diagnosis and really want treatment, you're looking for at least 6 of each of those things. So, you know, you want to make sure to go through. And always, you know, the fellows sometimes at the beginning, they come to me and they say, you know, patient just like this, hand and knee pain, and they'll start their physical exam, you know, when you do the precepting, you know, oh, well, on the MCPs, blah, blah, blah. But no, the neck is one of the joints that we're looking for because, you know, just like someone mentioned, you know, C1 and C2 are typically involved, but the rest of the C-spine also gets involved. The TMJs is another joint that gets involved, the SC joint, AC joint, you know, so you want to go through a systematic approach. And I know if you don't do it often, you're not that comfortable with it, but you know, that's definitely a part of it. And another thing is looking for rashes. You know, a patient may not have been told they have psoriasis, but they may have a plaque on their elbow. They may have a nodule that they haven't seen. They may have a nail pit, you know, these types of things. So you have to be very careful. And like I said, you want to document any actively inflamed joints, document any mechanical joint problems, or document any extra-articular manifestations. And I should have mentioned, you know, always look in the eyes, look in the mouth, and look for any rash or lymphadenopathy. Okay, so what labs are you going to send? So hopefully, you know, when you see these patients in clinic, you will all be doing the initial assessment and then refer them to us so that we have some baseline to work with. So what are some of the things you're going to want to check for? Mm-hmm. Good. Very good. Okay, so we basically said everything. You know, and of course, if the patient has one particular joint that's more swollen than the others, you have to perform an arthrocentesis, okay? And hopefully you all have at least seen one. And also, you know, if it's a patient who, in your review, has had any recurrent STDs or recurrent infections, you know, of any sort, you want to make sure to check for those things. And typically, when I send a rheumatoid factor, I'll send the hepatitis serologies as well. Because if it's a patient that we are going to diagnose with rheumatoid arthritis and we want to use one of the medications, they all have hepatotoxicity, so we need to make sure that they don't have hepatitis first anyway. But just because of the high tendency in this population for hepatitis C, we always check for it when we check the rheumatoid factor. And you want to x-ray the wrists and hands, the feet, and any other symptomatic joints. So the classification of function, it's very similar to other classification schema, where class 1, there's no limitations, class 2, the patient can do normal activities despite discomfort, class 3, they're getting a little sicker, they can't do most self-care, and class 4, which thankfully we don't really see that often, they're essentially chair-bound. And the ACR 20, 50, or 70 response criteria are what we use to assess our drug interventions, where you see a 20 through 70% improvement in swollen joint count and tender joint count, and at least three of the following, whether it's the patient's global assessment of disease activity, physician assessment, patient's assessment of pain, the disease markers, the inflammatory markers, or the patient's assessment of their disability, which is the HAC. And the HAC is a health assessment questionnaire. It's very easy to do. Typically, we have a staff hanging out in the clinic. We have a patient just answer 20 questions regarding 8 activities that they may routinely do. You know, how easy is it to dress yourself? How often are you, you know, socializing? These types of things. And it's been proven to be a pretty good indicator of functional performance. Another disease assessment is the DAS-28. You might hear us talking about this if you come to our grand rounds. It's an assessment and improvement or response to drug. And it's essentially a calculated figure looking at tender joints, swollen joints, ESR, and a global health status. In addition to all of these measures, we look at, you know, radiographic changes as a response to treatment, or to look at radiographic progression, where we look at erosion scores, joint space narrowing, and a total sharp score adds those two together. So some of the early markers in a patient that, you know, you may see, like that lady, generalized onset with numerous joints involved, systemic onset including fatigue, fever, weight loss, morning stiffness, an elevated CRP or SED rate, positive test for rheumatoid factor or CCP, particularly if they have early erosions or joint space narrowing. Like if you're diagnosing a patient who has early erosions and joint space narrowing at the time that they come to you, they're going to progress because you've already essentially missed that window of opportunity where their x-rays are still normal. But, you know, there's definitely still room for treatment, but these are definitely the patients who are going to progress and have a difficult course. Later on, they may have more joints involved, increasing morning stiffness, a high titer rheumatoid factor, and also their other indices for getting sick or anemia or thrombocytosis. And just like I mentioned before, any of the extra articular manifestations, including nodules, all those other things we talked about, those are definitive markers for sicker patients. Okay, so, you know, as you could see, early diagnosis is definitely important. So if you're suspicious that anyone has rheumatoid arthritis or any of the inflammatory arthropathies, they need to be diagnosed early and started on treatment because it's progressive. Structural damage or disability usually occurs within the first couple of years. And because treatment has been shown to slow the progression of disease, we like to intervene as early as possible. So this is just to show you that over, you know, the duration of disease, depending on how old the patient is at diagnosis, the inflammation, disability, and x-ray changes all progress. And it's, you know, because hopefully these curves can be reduced with treatment, that's why we want to get them on treatment early. Joint erosions occur, like I mentioned, you know, in almost all the patients, they have potentially joint problems on x-rays within the first couple of years. And even in the first 4 months, some studies have shown that MRIs can pick up erosions that early. And rate of progression is significantly more rapid in the first year than the second and third years. So, you know, like I said, and I'm going to keep saying this, if you see a patient early enough, the intervention that's earlier is much more significant for the patient, just because you could see the curve is much steeper over here. And this is really just to show you the difference between delayed treatment and early treatment as far as changing in the SHARP score, which was that X-ray assessment of disease progression. So our goals of treatment obviously are to eliminate synovitis and disease activity, improve symptoms, prevent joint damage, prevent reduced disability or other adverse outcomes. You know, I think these are probably the goals of treatment for every doctor for every disease process. But, you know, because it can be so severe and so disabling and now we have so many options, we really try to treat early and aggressively. Currently, we do have a lot of options. You know, for the list starts with the NSAIDs, steroids, the disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, and biologic agents. But, you know, as you all know and probably have seen just as much as myself, NSAIDs can certainly be very toxic, the COX-1, with GI toxicity and platelet dysfunction, and both of them can cause decreased renal blood flow, hepatic dysfunction, and several other problems. But the fact is, you know, these medications can treat the inflammation and the pain, but they're not going to do anything to alter the course of disease. So while NSAIDs may be good as a temporizing measure so the patient actually gets on a medication that makes them feel better as well, you know, NSAIDs really don't do anything for joint disease progression. And similarly with the steroids, you know, steroids have a ton of side effects and we use them when patients flare, but they certainly don't do anything for the joint spaces and for erosions, and they do cause early osteoporosis. So some of the traditional DMARDs, the disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, you see here, you probably have some patients on these medications. And just to be a little bit more specific, methotrexate. So methotrexate, you know, I explain it to my patients. It's really the cornerstone of all anti-rheumatic treatment. You know, used on its own, used in combination, you know, it's a good way to start. The people who should not be placed on methotrexate are people who have liver disease, people who are pregnant, people who want to get pregnant. And it can be used in people of childbearing age. It only has to be stopped 3 months before they want to start trying to have a child. But it is teratogenic, and it can cause liver toxicity. So these are people who do not belong in methotrexate. But otherwise, it's basically where we start for practically every patient, unless they drink heavily or have some other reason not to go on it. It's given once a week. It comes only as 2.5 milligrams, so you have to give it a few at a time. Sometimes patients are told if they're taking it for psoriasis, the dermatologists typically tend to space out the dose over the day, you know, 12 hours apart. We usually give it all at the same time, but if patients get nauseous, they can break it up. You know, if they're taking six pills a day or a six-pill dose, they could take two one morning, two that night, and two the following morning, but we usually use it in a concentrated fashion. And when I was in fellowship, the sub-Q methotrexate had run out, somehow was on a shortage, so we didn't have it, and it was only given as oral, but now it's back in the market, and typically when you get above 20 milligrams, it's thought that the absorption is not as good unless it's given subcutaneously. And some patients really just respond better to subcutaneous dosage. But like I said, it does have its potential toxicities, whether you know, hematologic or teratogenic, in some rare cases carcinogenic, that's what it's thought, at least in mice. It can also cause alopecia, and like I mentioned earlier, it can cause a pneumonitis or nodules. And in order to monitor patients, we have them come, you know, check their CBC, check an SMA every 4 weeks at first, and then every 6 to 8 weeks when they're on a stable dose. Leflunomide or Arava, it's another one of the main choices that we use for RA, one of the earlier ones, can be given with a loading dose of 100 milligrams a day for 3 days. Usual dose is 20 milligrams, and you have to do the same monitoring, and it basically has a very similar side effect profile as methotrexate. And if a patient overdoses, you have to get cholestyramine to rapidly remove the dose. The antimalarials, you probably see this more often used with lupus. Basically, every lupus patient is on Plaquenil for one reason or another. It's very good for the dermatologic manifestations of SLE, but we also sometimes use it for rheumatoid arthritis. It's not, it doesn't prevent the X-ray progression as well, but if there's a patient who, you know, is too afraid to use methotrexate or Arava or has reasons that, you know, it's not safe for them to use it, you may want to try Plaquenil as well. Sulfasalazine, that's another drug. This is also used in the inflammatory bowel diseases, as you know, typically given in divided doses. Also can cause the same toxicity. So basically, once you're starting a patient on a DMARD therapy, they do have to know that they're going to have to come in for monitoring. You know, once the doses are stable, it's not more often than 3 or 4 months, and that's how often you're going to want to see the patient anyway. So this is just to show you, you know, as you know, some of our newer and fancier medications that we're using these days really target the small molecules. And, you know, I explain it to patients, you know, we used to not really know exactly how rheumatoid arthritis happened, you know, what happened in your joint. But now, you know, we know all these steps along the pathway. We don't really know what the beginning is because, you know, as you know, it's an autoimmune disease like a lot of our other ones where we don't even quite know exactly what the antigen trigger is, but we know a lot of the steps along the pathway. So, you know, now we have a lot of different methods to neutralize these parts of the pathway, whether inhibition of a cytokine, whether a soluble receptor, whether getting in the way of the whether activating the anti-inflammatory pathway. And these are three main TNF blocking therapies. Most of you probably have heard of these, Enbrel, Remicade, Humira. Enbrel is a soluble TNF receptor. Remicade, which is IV, is a chimeric antibody to TNF, and Humira is a recombinant human antibody. And the Remicade is given intravenous, and these other two are given sub-Q. Prior to giving them, you have to make sure the patient does not have a positive PPD because these can reactivate tuberculosis. But if they do have a positive PPD, as long as there's no evidence of active tuberculosis and the patient hasn't had TB, you can certainly treat them or initiate treatment with INH and B6. You know, start them on the pathway for 9 months of treatment, and then after about 4 weeks of treatment, you can go ahead and give them one of these medications as long as they're aware of the potential risks. And some of the newer medications that we're using are really targeting B cells because they're so responsible for the pathogenesis of rheumatoid arthritis. One of them is rituximab, which you may have heard used for treatment for lymphoma. And in combination with methotrexate, it's been shown to reduce signs and symptoms of patients with moderate to severe RA who failed the TNF inhibitors because it's a B cell inhibitor. Another medication that we use, abatacept, it's a CTLA-4 IG, which basically, just so you know, now that we know the pathway to RA involves the B-cell-T-cell interaction, CTLA-4 is a negative stimulator for T-cell activation and B-cell production of antibodies. So essentially, we're trying to interrupt that connection with this medication. So, you know, I've said a lot at you, and you've been great in responding, but just, you know, to go back over, you know, what to do when you think a patient has RA. You know, you want to definitely establish the diagnosis very early to initiate therapy and, you know, periodically assess disease activity. So, you know, like I said, when you're seeing patients in clinic, if you're strongly suspicious, you know, definitely send all the labs. Feel free to start an NSAID. You know, you can call us and say, hey, you know, Dr. Schwartzman, or hey, rheumatology fellow, whoever you are, you know, I have this patient. I think she has RA. You know, what do you want me to do? Okay, so, and I'll be happy, you know, you page me directly. I'll be happy to say, okay, this is what you know, all the things that you guys already said. Send the rheumatoid factor. Get the x-rays of the hands and wrists. You know, send all these other things. Make sure the patient doesn't have HIV. And you know, have them come back and let me know how it goes, and then have them come see us as soon as possible so we can start treating them. You know, because then once we get to start therapy, we can periodically assess how they're doing. I typically check x-rays every year, especially once they're on medication. You want to monitor their labs. You know, and you have to have the patient come back and monitor their response to therapy, not just by x-rays, but by, you know, the patient's assessment. How are you feeling? How much have you been able to do? Are you able to participate in your life again? You know, a lot of patients are not used to having joint pain, and they can't write because they can't use their hands, and they can't carry their grocery bags, and they certainly have a difficulty driving or opening the door. So, you know, getting treatment early is not just to prevent the joint damage, but it's to prevent them from not being a part of their lives. So it's very important. You know, and so like I said, early methotrexate is typically what we do. If patients don't respond to methotrexate alone, I usually continue the methotrexate and just add to it. You know, studies have shown that combination therapy from the onset is definitely the best way to control a progressive disease process. Some of the older rheumatologists don't necessarily like to start that way, but I typically, if I have a patient who's told me, you know, for 4 months I've had these symptoms, and then when I see them, they have any periarticular osteopenia, they have a CCP antibody, I might start them on one of those biologic therapies with methotrexate, you know, in the second visit, just because, you know, it's definitely been shown to control disease better. But a lot of times methotrexate or ARAVA are what we start with, and then we add on. And the reasons to take away are less because of failure of the drug and more because of toxicity. Like I said, you know, combination therapy is really where we go. Okay, so I do have one more quick case report. It's more of just a review of a case just to show you another extra-articular severe manifestation, but I just wanted to stop if there's any questions. No, so that's a great question. You know, like I was saying, I usually wouldn't stop the methotrexate for sure unless there was a toxicity, or unless you maxed out, you know, let's say the patient's been on 20 or 25 milligrams for 2 years and, you know, no addition of anything else has helped, then you may want to say, okay, let's peel back and we'll change gears. But usually, you know, the earlier studies before the biologics show that combinations of three DMARDs together, methotrexate, sulfasalazine, and plaquenil, you know, were sufficient to control disease. So, you know, at a certain point, you know, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, once you learn the drugs, when you get more comfortable with which ones are more immune suppressive, like the methotrexate and ARAVA are definitely more immune suppressive than plaquenil. You know, that's a little bit milder. That's for someone who's not quite as willing to, you know, start themselves on treatment, who's a little bit more afraid of medications. I definitely see a lot of that in this area for some reason. You know, so you may not want to combine methotrexate, ARAVA, and Enbrel, but if the patient's on methotrexate and plaquenil, or ARAVA and plaquenil not doing so great, I would definitely add on a biologic if I thought that they were going to respond to it and weren't going to have toxicity from it. So... Yeah, I mean, if they're on three DMARDs and failing, then you probably want to stop one of those. I mean, I probably wouldn't continue, you know, methotrexate and ARAVA and add Humira, but certainly some people do. You may have to peel back after because, I mean, they are very immune suppressive and people do get sick. Last year we had a patient who had been PPD negative and developed disseminated TB while on Humira, and she had like a little lymph node that we picked up in clinic, and there was TB there, and it was in her knee and not in her lungs. She didn't have a cough, but you know, they definitely do cause the toxicities. But you know, the same patient came back to me today after being on her TB regimen for 12 months, and she's been off the Humira and wants it back again. Like, she said, I don't care. You could write in the chart that I told you it was okay. I don't care if I get TB again. You know, she's just suffering so much because, I mean, it really is disabling. So. Yeah, so that's a great question. He asked after how long would you expect a response? So we typically see one, depending on the drug, actually. So, you know, in methotrexate, I like to expect a response after 4 weeks. I mean, the half-life is about 6 weeks. So, you know, you may tell a patient you may not notice anything, you know, until about 2 months. The biologics, some patients respond after the first couple of doses. So, you know, if they're not responding after about 6 months on one of the biologic treatments, then we definitely consider switching to a different one. Because we would consider those primary failures, as opposed to somebody who, you know, responds and then is on it for a couple of years, and then they don't respond, you know, anymore. That's a secondary failure. But that's a very good question. Usually in the first month or two.
What can we do for somebody who has rheumatoid arthritis and long headaches?
Great question. So what can you do for somebody who has rheumatoid arthritis who now is HIV positive and has progressed to AIDS?
Yeah.
That's a great question. So I haven't seen too many rheumatoids with HIV because the T cell profile is actually the opposite of the one that would be active. So usually if a patient has HIV and it becomes fulminant, their rheumatoid arthritis tends to go in remission. The diseases that I've seen in this year alone with HIV are lupus and psoriatic arthritis, because the psoriatic arthritis is typically more of a CD8 T-cell disease. So that actually, if a patient has fulminant psoriatic arthritis, you know, presents with skin lesions, you know, psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, skin lesions, joint problems, you have to check them for HIV immediately. That could be their initial presentation, surprisingly enough. But, you know, what's safe to use? The patient who I have with lupus who has HIV is currently on CellCept, which is mycophenolate mofletil, and that's thought to, in certain case studies, reduce the viral load. I haven't seen enough patients who have both, but you know, that's something I would consider using. We have used Enbrel and Humira in hepatitis C patients who have rheumatoid arthritis, and we talk to the gastroenterologists about it all the time, and that's definitely something that's considered, you know, somewhat of a Class C safety profile. So if they were, you know, just HIV positive and didn't have a very high viral load, didn't already have, you know, all the other manifestations, I would probably discuss it with the ID people, but I might consider offering, you know, one of the milder DMARDs. It really depends on the disease, and it depends on the heart therapy that they're on, you know, because so many of those medications can cause hepatotoxicity, and so many of ours can. It can become difficult. Well, it depends on. So, I mean, I probably would consider offering the same things I would any patient if they had a, you know, normal T cell count. Just be very careful monitoring them. Any other questions? Okay, so we have just a couple more minutes. Just one more quick. 57-year-old man who was admitted to a hospital affiliated. I don't know what this is. Basically, came in with dyspnea and dry cough for 2 weeks. He had a previous diagnosis of RA, and he had painful swelling of the joints 2 years prior to admission. He was being treated with prednisone and gold, which is one of the earlier DMARDs. We don't really use that anymore, so I didn't talk about it, but essentially you could say prednisone and methotrexate. Patient with diffuse pulmonary rheumatoid nodules and interstitial fibrosis throughout both lungs. This was the patient that we saw. The patient with articular symptoms and seropositivity exhibited a rapid clinical course and died of respiratory failure 3 months after the appearance of dyspnea. So, you know, again, like I said, I brought this case up. I brought up the case at the beginning just because I know, you know, in residency, the bulk of what you see is cardiopulmonary problems. That's the bottom line. But our diseases can also have those things too. So this is the patient where his chest x-ray at the time of admission, where you could see bilateral shadows, especially in the periphery. CT of his chest showed reticular nodule opacities, little effusions. And these were his lungs. This is the right lung with bulla, and this is the surfaces of the lungs with a lot of nodules. And you could see the pathology here. This is the path of the lung, basically showing a rheumatoid nodule, which would be the same thing, like I said, that's happening in the nodules on the forearms, happening in the joint space, so with a ton of macrophages and multinucleate giant cells. Okay, so like I said, the chest x-ray showed interstitial pneumonitis, bilateral pleural effusions. At autopsy, he had numerous rheumatoid nodules and interstitial fibrosis, which had destroyed both lungs, and there was no normal pulmonary tissue. So, you know, essentially, this is a patient who, you know, he had rheumatoid arthritis, he had shortness of breath, and it, you know, it wasn't just pneumonia, it wasn't heart failure, but it was interstitial pneumonitis as a part of his RA and lung nodules. So hopefully, even though I know this was a lot at one time, hopefully you learned something. And like I said, if you ever see a patient that you're curious about or just want to talk about, please feel free to call and discuss, and hopefully we'll see all of you in the elective, and I'm always around. Thank you. So she said, how often do you see patients who have lupus and RA? That's a great question, because it's definitely a difficult treatment point, because the Enbrel, Humira, that class of medications can, in rare cases, cause lupus. There is a disease entity called rupus, which is an overlap of RA and lupus. I have two patients, and I've seen maybe five in the last, 4 years that I've been doing this. But it's not that common. But definitely autoimmune diseases cluster in families and in patients. So it's more common that you'd see a lupus patient who also has myositis, or a lupus patient who also has a thyroid disease, or RA, with both of those things too. Okay, thank you.